You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today, we'll be talking about the student expulsion rates at Richmond City Schools and exploring the current state of political fact-checking. We'll also preview this weekend's Yes Dance Invitational. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Could resolution be at hand in the matter of A.V. Norrell Elementary School? Richmond School's officials and representatives of a community organization that has protested the school's reopening met Wednesday to discuss the school. A meeting moderated by the Richmond Department of Health sought to find common ground, but also included a number of angry exchanges between Richmond School's Chief Operating Officer Andy Hawkins and Art Burden, a community organizer who founded Parents for Life in 2001. The school is currently home to one of the district's early childhood education programs. It reopened this year over objections that included concerns that the school was built on a trash dump and that a history of methane gas and waste-related toxins might endanger children. Danny Avila, the health department's deputy director, worked to broker the meeting between the two sides. Though critical of the school system's failure to include the community in the decision to reopen the school, Avila attempted to reassure opponents that the testing data indicated that the school is no longer a health or safety risk. "I feel really good about the testing that was done," Avila told the group, promising as a first step to resolve that the Richmond District Health Department would prepare a document that really assures the safety of the children in the school. For more on A.V. Norrell and to view 6 decades of city, state, and federal documents related to Norrell and ongoing public health concerns related to dangerous levels of methane gas and toxins detected there over the years, go to the Open Source RVA Facebook page and click on our link to the document archive. Next Friday, Equality Virginia, along with MCV Health Collective and the VCU Office of Multicultural Student Affairs, will host the LGBT Public Health Listening Tour, and they want community input. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services issued its first ever LGBT annual report in June of this year, detailing LGBT-relevant issues such as hospital visitation, HIV/AIDS strategy, adoption and foster regulations, and affordable health care, in response to a 2010 Obama memo requesting recommendation on health and human service issues affecting LGBT people and their families. More information from the LGBT public on what can be done to improve their health is officially requested. To register, send an email with name, organization, title, email address, and phone number to tdavis@equalityvirginia.org or call 804-643-4816 by Wednesday, October 24th. The event starts at 9:30 a.m. on Friday, October 26th, and goes until noon in the VCU Student Commons.
When two local elected officials sent a letter last week to Henrico County Public Schools Superintendent Pat Rousseau seeking an answer to the district's disturbingly high rate of suspensions meted out to African American students, their query touched on a symptom of a much more wide-ranging social ill. The cradle-to-prison pipeline, the concept that our education system's predisposition to punish and even sometimes to criminalize poor and minority children in school, increasing their likelihood of later imprisonment, is a social ill of epidemic proportions. 1 in 3 African-American boys born in this decade will spend time in prison in their lifetimes. And it's an ill that may be worsened by the relentless pressure on educators to show improvement in test scores. The pipeline presents a vicious cycle, according to advocates for minority students, and it's a problem few communities have the courage to confront. I'm here with Henrico Verina, supervisor and pastor of Six Mount Zion Church in Richmond, Pastor Tyrone Nelson. Kathy Greenier, director of the Patricia M. Arnold Women's Rights Project at the ACLU of Virginia, and Tichy Pinckney-Epps, a longtime student advocate in Richmond and a former president of the Richmond City Council of PTAs. Thank you guys for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're talking, of course, about an issue that is not new, although it, of course, has in the headlines recently with Henrico County getting a little bit of a notice, I suppose, put on it for suspension of disproportionate suspension of African-American students and African-American males, I believe, is sort of where we were landing. And this really is sort of a pervasive issue. It's been ongoing for decades, and I've reported on it my time. And this most recent case was I guess, Pastor Nelson, you had some things to say about it. Is that true?
Yes, sir. Two weeks ago, Senator McEachin and I wrote a letter to the superintendent of Henrico County Public Schools, Dr. Pat Russo, asking for some plan of action to, I guess, in some way address the high suspension rates of special needs in African American males in the county. And so there's a report that came out sometime at the beginning of August from a project done at UCLA, and it's public. And both of us had the opportunity to read it in August, and since then we've been dialoguing with the superintendent and really are concerned about the amount of suspensions that are happening with African-American males. And so the report was focused on 2009, and 2009 there were, I think, roughly around 12,000 suspensions. 75% of those suspensions were for African-American students. Mm-hmm. And disproportionately, I think 90% of those suspensions were for male students. And so for that was 2009, and once we were pressed to get some more information from the school system, we found out that 75% or thereabout have been suspended through 2012. And so we're just looking for some answers why so many students, particularly when African Americans are only 37% of the population in the county.
And it's a growing population in the county. It's almost equal to white students now.
Right. We're getting close. The minority students in the county, period, are the majority now. And so, but the balance between
which makes it even more striking, really.
Right. And it's it's a challenge. That's why we're waiting on some answers now. Every day I look at my email and look in the mailbox, waiting to hear back to see what the plan of action is.
And have not heard.
At this point, no response.
It's interesting. In 2009, that was the same year I did a story at Style Weekly about Richmond Public Schools, and they had somewhere in the range of course, it's a student population of 24,000, and I think it was somewhere around, there it is right there. It was 13,500 suspensions. So, I mean, it was just a huge amount. And D.C. during that same period was they recognized that they had a suspension problem, an epidemic, right. And it was 1,000 suspensions that had them upset, and they were going in to try and figure out how to lessen that number. Mm. Now, Kathy, I guess the ACLU is very much interested in this. Real quick, just to back up myself, I guess, before I ask you this question, it seems like it's kind of a labyrinthine issue. The suspension issue is related to even maybe the diagnosis, I guess, by the school district of special needs students. You have a much higher ratio of African-American males specifically diagnosed as learning disabled than you do even African-American females, but certainly white population. And then it's related, too, to expulsions. It's related at some level to test scores and to testing, the number of students that are, in fact, actually tested. There was a recent case in El Paso. There's a story in the New York Times on the 13th, I think, of this month that was about El Paso's superintendent was caught with his hand in the cookie jar, basically having used, I think it was student discipline or switching classes around, and basically is now charged with a crime for what was essentially doctoring test scores at the end was his purpose. Where does the ACLU factor into all of this? And I guess you guys are taking some sort of issue umbrage with overall.
The ACLU nationally and the ACLU of Virginia specifically is deeply concerned about what we like to call the school-to-prison pipeline. And the school-to-prison pipeline refers to the national trend of criminalizing rather than educating our nation's children. And we see the school-to-prison pipeline as one of the most important civil rights challenges facing our nation today. And you're certainly correct to point out the multifaceted ways that this pipeline affects our children. So the pipeline encompasses the growing use of zero-tolerance discipline policies, school-based arrests, disciplinary alternative schools, secured detention. All of these marginalize our most at-risk youth and deny them access to education. And specifically, children with special needs are disproportionately represented in the pipeline despite heightened protections afforded to them by law. Children with unmet special learning needs or emotional needs are particularly likely to be pushed out of school into the juvenile justice system. And of course, as you mentioned, with the advent of high-stakes testing, No Child Left Behind, we're increasingly seeing a push out of students in order to meet the goals of that high-stakes testing policy.
And there's some incentivizing as well of it. In fact, the El Paso case, there was some of that. I think it was if he improved his test scores by a certain, he could get a bonus or something along these lines. We had a similar situation in this state, in Richmond, where the superintendent, coming in, not the current superintendent, but the previous superintendent, Jewel Sherman, was offered a bonus for improving test scores by a certain amount. And there was some correlation between her achievement of that and the fact that that same year, I believe it was special ed students, you saw a number of them pushed out of the system. So fewer kids to take the test, essentially, is the objective. I mean, it's you can understand why that incentive would be there. These are the kids that are the most difficult to educate. They're going to take more, resources. It's tough. Teachy, we've talked before a little bit about effective school-wide discipline over the years. That is the policy in Richmond. It's the policy in Henrico, too. Not effective school-wide discipline. Talking about zero tolerance. Zero tolerance is the policy in Richmond. It's the policy in Henrico. And does it work?
I don't think it works. My concern is that with zero tolerance policies, we're actually punishing children as opposed to correcting their behaviors.
It's interesting when I did the story for Style, and I don't know what the case is, Pastor Nelson, you might be able to tell me, is in Henrico, but in Richmond, a lot of the suspensions actually were for truancy. So it was a child being put out of school for being out of school.
Right.
Have you guys gotten anything on?
And actually, I think 2009, grassroots group that I was working with then, RISC, I think also was involved in that truancy piece back in 2008, 2009.
Yep.
And we were concerned then that, we were doing what kids wanted, which were, they were skipping school and then we were suspending them for it. So I'm not really sure. And again, it goes back to just looking for more information. And what I believe is we've been following this pattern of suspending kids. And for whatever reason, whatever the rationale is, it's been happening. And so hopefully now, by us asking the question and it becoming a public conversation, that the school system, even now, hopefully as we're talking, somebody is really kind of digging into those numbers and finding out what the... And a part of my question was when I spoke with the superintendent, or me and the superintendent were dialoguing back and forth, was give me some specifics. Is it a specific school, specific teachers, specific targets for why kids are being suspended? What's the
Who was asking who for that?
I was asking the superintendent. That's what I asked the superintendent. So those are the questions that I'm looking to get the answers for.
You want
to
know?
Yeah, I want to know why. I want to know, first of all, who are these 9,000 students? What are we suspending them for? And it's a bigger problem. I'm not crazy enough to believe that it's just discipline in the schools. I know that there are some community things that are happening. I know some, there are some things that happen even as it relates to teachers. You know, I know the county speaks a lot about being culturally sensitive in their preparation. Well, what's the data? You know, show us that people are being trained to work with, different cultures, et cetera. And I haven't seen it.
Teachy, you're over there shaking your head. With the PTA, when you were the president of the PTA, I guess we spoke a lot about this issue. You had a child that had some issues, some run-ins with the district, right?
I recall that we discussed my son, who had graduated at the time from Richmond Public Schools. But what I found while he was in high school, my son was at least 210 pounds, and there was one teacher in particular that at the end of the day, it was his size that was intimidating to her. And if he would come into the classroom late, and of course he should not have been doing that, but if he would respond to her, she would immediately call security. You've got to get out of my classroom.
Wow, that's a heck of a reaction.
So,
let me just say this before I know you want to jump back in. there was one of the young men that I know. He goes to Virginia State, and I think a day or two after the article came out, his class talked about this. And just, I won't say what school, but one of the administrators of a county school is in one of those classes, and she shared pretty much what Ms. Epps just said, that part of some of what the challenges are really do revolve around things like adults being intimidated or afraid, not even intimidated, but afraid of young people and not knowing how to respond or how to react. And so their natural inclination sometimes is just send them to the office or, deal with them in a way instead of really realizing that these are young people. And the last thing I'll say is this. I think the biggest struggle for me in Henrico County is the county spent a lot of time over the last 2 years talking about achievement gaps between black and white students. And it just amazes me for a county that will spend as much time talking about achievement gaps that they will continue to suspend kids.
Well, and I guess one of the easy ways to close that achievement gap is to show improvement in scores.
Right.
And the scores, sometimes the way to show the improvement is to simply not have to test the child. Or Kathy, you were going to say?
I was going to say that perhaps what's most galling about these zero-tolerance discipline policies is not only the fact that there's no evidence that those policies make schools safer or improve student conduct, but research actually shows that the overuse of suspensions and expulsions may increase the likelihood of later criminal misconduct. Hmm. So by using these policies that schools think are helping, they're actually making the problem worse, and they're making the problem of the school-to-prison pipeline a faster pipeline, so to speak, a faster chute once students are pushed out and then pushed into the juvenile justice system. And I think that I would echo the sentiments expressed here that we need to have some questions answered. It was reported in the Richmond Times-Dispatch that the school system said it will not relax its standards for student conduct and performance, but why continue to use what doesn't work?
And that's, I misspoke earlier about effective school-wide discipline. That is something that the city of Richmond has implemented in, I believe, some of its elementary schools, possibly some of the middle schools as well. It's a sort of an overlay. They've refused, as I recall, Teachy, correct me if I'm wrong, to do away with zero tolerance policies, but in order to try to mitigate some of it, they have implemented this effective school-wide discipline policy, which is essentially a system of rewards at the front end to try to improve student behavior. Do you have any suggestions? Is the ACLU making any sort of suggestions for how to improve the situation, or is that's not really your purview, I guess?
In other school systems, in other states, I'm aware of alternative discipline methods that have been imposed in order to move away from the zero tolerance discipline policies. And in other states, we've seen dedicated activists and educators who want to put a halt to the school-to-prison pipeline work together in order to reach out to the types of specialists and experts in child psychology, adolescent development, and work on alternative models to discipline that are actually going to be helping our youth and improving student conduct in ways that are sensible and not making the problem worse. And I just wanted to make one more comment about the disproportionate impact that these policies have on youth of color. And this should be obvious. It should go without stating. But one of the things that I think is really key to make mention of is that there's absolutely no evidence that students of color misbehave to a greater degree than white students. But what we do see is that students of color are punished more severely, often for behaviors that are less serious than the behaviors that white students are getting punished for.
This is based on data?
Yes. This is based on research, national research. And so I think as we're trying to get a handle...
That sort of goes back to what Pastor Nelson and Tichy, you were saying, is a child who maybe looks intimidating is going to be more likely to be punished to have the hammer come down, essentially.
That's true.
It's a startling, I guess, that it's... I mean, it shows in the data, nationwide data, that it's not just a... You know, my child or his child or her child. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. I just wrote down a note to just make mention of. I think we're a numbers driven society, and I think unfortunately sometimes that doesn't work in the school society. I mean, it doesn't work. But somewhere along the line, somebody decided these are good scores, and when you dangle the goal out of what is success in front of administrators, they're going to have to go for it if their job performance is determined based upon numbers. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happens, and so that's why we have made this transition away from when I was in school just 20 years ago. Teachers, if they were teaching to the test, we didn't know it. You know, they were being creative, and I felt like I was learning. Now, my child, I got a seventh grader, and, you know, I don't feel like he's learning much of anything. He's memorizing a lot of things, but he's not really learning a lot. And, you know, I think we're doing our kids a disservice. I really do. And I think a lot of that plays into discipline as well.
Oh, it sounds like part of the conversation that really needs, this is from listening to the conversation here, is part of the conversation community-wide that needs to happen is considering these issues, frankly, of race and socioeconomic class, and those are hard issues to get into. They're very uncomfortable for people to talk about. Mm-hmm. But in a situation like this, you're talking about a child's future. Mm-hmm. You're not just talking about, well, this is embarrassing to discuss. I mean, I don't know how you deal with that, I guess, as a district. Is it really the school district's responsibility to enter into that discussion? How do we move forward with an issue like that that's so pervasive?
I think definitely it's the school's responsibility to delve into those the challenges that the students present with. For instance, in Richmond Public Schools, it's 97% African American. So, of course, our numbers are high with regard to the discipline of the African American males. But I want to piggyback on what Tyrone was saying earlier about, you know, everything is data driven, it's to the numbers. Well, I'd like to say, okay, if we're going to work to the number, then assign each child a number. Number one gets all of their needs met. Number two gets all of their needs met, and so on, and such that when we do go report, we have personalized it. We've built relationships with these children such that we know we are educating whole children. I know that kind of sounds like very ideological or, you know, naive, but if we're talking about data, then let's assign a number to each of our children. That number represents their portfolio, what they need, and we should go about providing that educational resource.
Well, I guess we all look forward to hearing what Henrico County has to say to you guys and asking your question, and look forward to seeing where this thing might lead us as a community. Thank you guys very much for being here. And again, I'm talking with Henrico Verina, supervisor and pastor of Six Mount Zion Church, Reverend Tyrone Nelson. And I'm with Kathy Greenier. She's director of the Patricia M. Arnold Women's Rights Project at the ACLU of Virginia. And also with Tichy Pinckney Epps. She's a longtime student advocate and a former president of the Richmond City Council of PTAs. Thank you guys for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tough issue to confront. Thank you.
Broadcast of WRAR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, presenting an exhibition of designs for the VCU Institute for Contemporary Art by Stephen Hole Architects, September 13th through October 18th at the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
Ask anyone plugged into the local performing arts scene, Richmond is a dance town. Patrons can find a plethora of talented and creative dance companies performing regularly across the city in venues big and small. Companies such as the Richmond Ballet, the Ground Zero Dance Company, the Azibu Muntu African Dance Company, the Latin Ballet, the Star Foster Dance Project, and the Concert Ballet of Virginia, among others. But no one has done more to promote and further the cause of dance in Richmond than Kay Weinstein Gary, who started the K-Dance Company 12 years ago. Among other things, K-Dance has put on the Yes Virginia Dance program since 1999. This two-night fiesta of contemporary dance has brought forth a rich array of regional and national artists, dancers, and choreographers to produce an unusually rich production of contemporary dance and theater. Now in its 14th year, the show has a new name. It's now simply called Yes Dance Invitational. And it's got a new venue, the Firehouse Theater. This year's production kicks off tonight and continues tomorrow night at the Firehouse. And I'm pleased and honored to have Kay Weinstein Gary and K-Dance board member Rebecca Jones here with me today on Open Source RVA. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start with your story, Kay. While you are the artistic director of this great annual event, you've actually been around longer than that as a dancer and as a teacher. Is that right?
That's correct. We won't talk about how many years, but I'm a seasoned performer, starting really in the academic world and then moving to more solo performances that I did across the state. And when it became necessary for me to be bigger, then we formed K-Dance. And it works usually two or three major projects a year, Yes Dance Invitational being one of those.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, tell me, you said you worked extensively in theater. Tell me a little bit about that and that side of you.
Well, that started probably 13, 14 years ago when I decided I wanted to speak on the stage as well as move. Mm-hmm. So combining text and movement or nonverbal, verbal ways of expressing yourself. So I decided that I needed to merge myself into the theater world, taking acting classes, delving into plays as a source of inspiration, really. Mm-hmm.
Well, you started the company in the year 2000?
Yes.
What made you want to start your own company? That's a rather daunting proposition. to do that?
Actually, probably my husband. He's the business partner. And I was working, getting grants and having physical agents like 1708. They were one of the first ones because they, in order to get some grants, you need to be a nonprofit. Right. So my husband said, let's go for it. He did all the groundwork, all the legwork, and made this company. And then I'm the artistic director. So that's how it happened, really.
Well, Rebecca, would you agree with me that Richmond has an unusually vibrant dance community?
Absolutely. I think this is just a great time in Richmond for the performing arts in general and for dance in particular. I think what's happened in the performing arts scene in the last 10 or 15 years, the rise of these fantastic storefront theaters that are open to collaborative projects with companies like K-Dance, like Ground Zero and some of the other companies that you mentioned. It's a very natural kind of collaboration, but it seems to be happening in a very big way right now, and it's an exciting time.
What would be your guess as to why there are so many creative, even world-class dance troupes in the city? Is it the VCU dance program that produces so much of this?
Yeah, well, I think the VCU arts entity really energizes so much of what's happening. I think for a long time there was maybe a mistaken impression that it was the visual arts that drove that movement. I don't think that was ever really the case, but I do think that the VCU contribution to all of the performing arts has just been a great thing. And and I think on the other side of the equation, the professional artistic community here in Richmond, it's a very nice symbiotic relationship that we can train them here and sort of and grow our own artists and hopefully have them stay here or certainly return here to do what they do.
Well, Kay, can you take a look back and tell me how the annual K-Dance Invitational got its start? What was the inspiration? The artistic inspiration.
Oh, wow, that's a good question. I wanted to collaborate and work with some other dance people here in Richmond, and so I went to Chris Burnside, who was on the faculty there at the Department of Dance and Choreography at VCU, and I said, I'd like to do a project together. And he said, okay, let's do a project together. And from there it grew to not just our working together, but in inviting some other folks to join us in that production. And from there, it's just grown and grown and grown and grown. And from a sort of a regional area now to national. This year, people are coming from Texas and New Jersey and Illinois and Maryland.
Well, talk a little bit about the evolution of the show. What were some of the memorable dance companies that have come in the past and previous installments of the Invitational?
For the past 5 years, we have been able to engage a person that Dance Magazine lists. They are 25 to watch in the country. And for the last 5 years, we've presented each year one of those listings. And this year it's Courtney Jones. Mm-hmm. But each year those have been quite a highlight.
Right. She's from Houston, Texas.
Correct.
And she's the guest
for this year.
Right.
And she's one of those 25 to watch.
Right. Talk a little bit about her. What makes her special and what will she be doing at the
She's
this
doing
year's?
A solo that is part of a larger work. She dances with Hope Stone Dance in Texas, Houston, Texas. She's not the choreographer of this solo. It's a solo, but she's a passionate, energetic dancer and just like a little spitfire on the stage.
Oh, okay. Well, Rebecca, you get in on this too. What made you want to change the name of the event and to move the venue from the Gray Street Theater to the Firehouse this year?
Well, the return, I say return, it feels like a return to the Firehouse because, in fact, K-Dance as a company has done so much interesting work at the Firehouse Theater. This is the first year that we're having the Invitational at the Firehouse. And I think that my impression, at least from having been in those conversations with the board, was that a lot of the momentum to do that grew out of the contribution that Kay Dance made to the third play in the Firehouse season last year, the series of one acts by Israel Horowitz, You Don't Know Me, mm-hmm. and with interludes of original dance pieces by Kay Dance interspersed with those. And it feels to me like Kay Dance and the Invitational, and my sense is that the contemporary dance scene in general is become that membrane between theater and dance is mm-hmm. getting more and more permeable, and so the space changing to that theatrical space seemed like a nice way to underscore that piece of the evolution. Mm-hmm. And then my sense in the original name of the festival was Yes, Virginia Dance.
Right.
And my impression was that in part that the idea behind altering that name a little bit was to reflect the real regional and national mm-hmm. scope of this festival. It's Virginia plays a role, but it's certainly not a Virginia dance right. festival. It's a national festival.
And also the word invitational, we liked that because that is exactly what it is. People apply, mm-hmm. then they're invited to perform.
Right, and you had mentioned Courtney Jones. What other guest artists will be on the schedule this year? What other dance companies and performers?
We have a company from Chicago, Winifred Hahn and Dancers. Then we have a company from, well, actually it's a duet, but they're from Maryland, Adrian Clancy and Sandra Lacey. Treeline Dance Works is from New Jersey. So that's our lineup. Mm-hmm. Winifred's doing two pieces, and Kay Dance will be doing two pieces. So there's seven pieces in all in this concert.
Yeah, the annual program is known for integrating some intriguing music into the mix. And this year, I understand there'll be a special performance set to the music of the Talking Heads.
You got it. That's my work.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that. Now that you're doing Life During Wartime?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
great.
Yes. I just loved working with that. I love the Talking Heads anyway. And this piece of music, Life During Wartime, is just such a strong piece, and it has to do with what we're dancing about, prejudice and aggression, people treating people mean.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and that's perfect, the lyrics. And the lyrics I do use in the piece as text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the special dances on display this weekend will be an adaptation of playwright Wendy Wasserstein's Boy Meets Girl, overseen by the theater director Billy Christopher Maupin. What's up next for Kay Dance after this weekend's big show? Any other big projects? Are you going to take it easy for a while?
I don't think I take it easy.
No. She doesn't.
Relatively.
I'm very interested in something that I did last year called shorts. So I take short plays, usually for hire four directors, they audition for these plays, then I put movement throughout the whole evening, mm-hmm. and I call it shorts. So I'm hoping to do that, working on that now for the spring probably.
Great.
But that's the next thing, shorts.
Well, let's tell the people, how much are tickets to the event this weekend, or events, I should say, and where can interested parties purchase those?
Right. The tickets are $20 for adults and $15 for students and Wrapped members. That's the Richmond Association Professional
Theater.
Is that
for both nights or one night?
It's the same program all three times.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, same program.
Gotcha.
So you can... And then it's $12 for the Firehouse subscribers.
Mm.
And all of the tickets are available online through the Firehouse website or 355-2001. I think that's the Firehouse.
I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking to Kay Weinstein Gary, the artistic director of the Kay Dance Company, and Rebecca Jones, a board member of Kay Dance. They'll be presenting the annual Yes Dance Invitational this weekend at the Firehouse Theater. You can get tickets at firehousetheater.org. The Yes Dance Invitational has become a signature dance event in a town that is known for great dance. And you can get more information at kdance.org. That's the letter K, dance.org. Thanks again for joining us on Open Source RVA.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, call 804-771-5715 or visit www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
Check your facts. In 1950, former Florida Senator George A. Smathers gave perhaps the most devastatingly factual campaign speech of all time against incumbent Senator Claude Red Pepper, accusing his opponent's family of all manner of decidedly unscandalous behavior. His youngest brother wrote an essay extolling the virtues of being a Homo sapien. His great aunt expired from a degenerative disease. His nephew subscribed to a phonographic magazine. In today's political climate, would Smathers have gotten away with this use of expansive, if creative, vocabulary? Who knows? What he wouldn't have gotten away with so easily, thanks to fact-checking news outlets like PolitiFact and FactCheck.org, is any bending or twisting of the real facts. I'm here with Ernest McGowan. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Richmond, and we're talking a little bit about political campaigns and fact-checking organizations like FactCheck.org and PolitiFact and even Snopes, and how they might play into how voters might go or might not go, or if they do at all. Mr. McGowan, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And, I mean, this is such a fascinating thing over the past, since the Internet was born, I guess the first of these was Snopes. And Snopes was very general interest. It was looking at just about anything and everything. But it did veer into the political, and I guess somebody got the idea that it would be a good thing to do more of a professional political fact-checking. And so FactCheck.org and PolitiFact were born. How have these affected, if at all, voters over the years since they've come on the scene?
Well, I think the main benefit that you get from those kind of sites is that they're perceived to be nonpartisan. I mean, most scholars, political scientists definitely believe that they're nonpartisan and media members. And so when they do make a certain claim about a politician, like their pants are on fire or something like that, it's not immediately dismissed by the other side. And if you actually go a little bit deeper into their reporting of it, it's very detailed. Like, they explain a lot more in depth as to why they are making the kind of claim that they are.
Yeah, it's often very impressive looking at sort of how they source things, and they'll go and kind of dig in. Although one of the criticisms I've seen of them in recent years is that, oh, well, they tend to go after one party or the other, and it's proof of media bias because they tend to go after Republicans, or as they become more frequent commentators on issues, is there the potential that people start to politicize them as well?
I think that they're really going to try very hard to stay down the middle because they occupy a very interesting place in our political discourse. And I would say I've seen the same types of studies that show that they're pretty far down the middle. If they were leaning towards the left, you can bet that there would be one on the right in the next couple of days to fill that vacuum. And so, you know, those claims are always going to be made, but I don't think the academic evidence is really there to support it.
No, and in fact, I guess what the PolitiFact guys do is they give an award every year for the pants on fire or something. And I think last year it was the Democratic Congressional Committee or something that had won it.
Right.
Ironically, for a Paul Ryan
right.
Fact that wasn't so factual. Right. Now, that was an interesting one, I guess, was and there's been much hay made over this, is Ryan's speech during the Republican National Committee convention was rather littered with some questionable facts. and it was heavily picked over by fact check organizations, which found lots of problems with it. Why do politicians, oh gosh, this is such a loaded question. Why do our politicians lie? Why is it okay?
Well, I don't think that they lie. There's always a sliver of truth behind a lot of the things that they say. And one thing about Paul Ryan that is definitely true is that out of all the convention speeches, his was one of the few that actually attempted to talk about facts, that actually attempted to put out real policies and contrast policies one way or another that were actually getting away from a lot of the talking points. And so maybe it was just a case that there was a lot more meat in Paul Ryan's speeches than there were in the others, and that's why the different websites gave it such due.
So they were digging in. There was less bread, a lot more meat.
Right.
You don't see as much of this happening on a local level yet. I was looking a review of sort of the local PolitiFact, and they tend to focus still on the big races. Right now the Cantor Powell race seems to be a fun one for them. or the Allen and right. Kane race is another one that they seem to be having they're just chewing things to pieces on that one. Is there a value to something like this going lower?
Well, it's all a balancing act. You have to go into the races that people actually care about, that the turnout is going to be particularly high. And so if there's not a large demand for you to fact check those kind of races, then it doesn't make economic sense for them. The other thing that I would say is that the larger the race, the bigger the paper trail. The more well-known the candidate, the larger the kind of history of different kinds of votes and different kind of policies and things like that. It's a lot easier just to turn on the internet and get the Congressional Budget Office budgets and then fact check what one person has said about another, as opposed to digging a lot deeper into county records or city records and things like that.
So it's almost low-hanging fruit,
right,
in a way. It would be more difficult to go digging in with say, Mayor Jones or with Henrico County Board of Supervisors.
Right. And then you have to just think about the import of the race, if you will. And so, you know, more people, I would venture to say, care about the Eric Cantor race or the Kane Allen race than do the Richmond mayoral election or the county board of supervisors.
Is that necessarily the right priorities list? I mean, we live locally.
Right. Well, as I teach my students in media class, the media is a for-profit business, and so their business model is going to survive above all.
Generally speaking, I guess. How does this affect voters at the polls? Have we seen any sort of, or is there any polling or study done of how this might affect voters as they reach the ballot box and are making their selection of a candidate?
Well, it'd be very difficult to study something like that because you would have to ask voters basically whether or not they were affected by PolitiFact. What we do know is that it's had a large effect on the media and the way the media reports these kinds of stories. And so when voters consume certain types of media and then they are told what is and is not factually correct, then they definitely use that in making their decision about the candidates. Because in addition to the actual policies that they're talking about, there's also a personality issue or credibility issue that comes from that. And so if you're constantly being reported as someone whose pants are moderately on fire, if you will, then voters are going to build up an idea about you that maybe you play fast and loose with the truth, which may hurt you more than the actual policies that you were discussing in your statement.
We were talking about this before the show started. Why ignore that? I mean, I guess you do see politicians and I think the way you'd put it is it's better to have more facts, so to speak, in a speech, even if some of them aren't quite on the target.
Well, what we know is that the key for politicians is to try to define their opponent and to make a running narrative about how their opponent is and the policies that their opponent would enact. And so if you can kind of come up with some creative math that may not be entirely accurate, but still fits into this larger narrative that you've been building for months or even years about a person, then in some cases, it's almost worth it. And then when you think about the types of people that will actually go forward and check a fact-checking website or a PolitiFact website, those kind of people are usually sophisticated enough to kind of see through what you're saying. And so it's the people that will not actually encounter this check on what the politician is saying that they're probably going for most often.
Well, and maybe that goes back to how's it affecting the voter. I mean, we do seem to be in sort of a polarized time politically, and I guess you could debate that as a political science too. Is yeah, you hear people say, "Oh no, it's no worse than it used to be." Or, but I think arguably you could say that at least in terms of the discourse, things have gotten a little uglier than it was 10 years ago, maybe, or 15 years ago. But is things like, I guess, just sticking this out in people's faces, here's this guy's lying, this guy's lying, this guy's – and it I guess it is the other side of some of the talk show stuff where you have sort of the facts just thrown around however you feel like it, but it's very much an emotional thing. Is it – helping or hurting in any way, do you think, in terms of sort of escalating the discourse? And would it really have the likelihood of swaying a voter, or is it simply more of a cement, a glue to what people already believe?
It's definitely about a credibility issue. So if Paul Ryan is saying something that I believe is untrue, I can surely find a Democrat surrogate that's going to tell me that Paul Ryan is being untruthful.
Right.
Or the same thing on the other side. And so if I were to try to seek out that kind of counterpoint of the information, I could readily find it. I could find the same research people that are going to tell me the same thing about what Paul Ryan was saying. Now, when it comes to the media, I encounter the media, especially the quote-unquote mainstream media or some of the radio stations. When I encounter them, I'm looking for a credible down-the-middle source. Of course, there are partisan media on both sides, but when I encounter the what I perceive to be an evenly balanced media program, and then they tell me that actually what Paul Ryan is saying is wrong, then I don't reject it as readily. And so that would I would give that more credibility in making my decision as to whether or not I'm going to believe and therefore support what Paul Ryan's plan is than if I got it from a partisan source.
So it sounds like you're saying there's the possibility that a voter who isn't necessarily on the fence but who is less cemented for a candidate, if he comes across his candidate or his possible candidate as frequently having some heat in the drawers area, he might decide, well, maybe not.
Definitely. Just in the exact same way a candidate that runs an overly negative campaign is going to feel a kind of backlash that has nothing to do with the actual policies that they're putting out. But again, it's a character issue. And so if you are someone that is constantly being exposed as playing fast and loose with the truth, then the person is going to start thinking, well, what are they going to do when they actually get in office?
So it sounds like a what did we do before these guys were here sort of a situation.
well, not really, because what we were definitely seeing, and this comes with the advent of cable news and the proliferation of news outlets, is that increasingly the media was becoming interpreters. So when we talk about the media is kind of caught in a bind between the rock and the hard place. So on the one hand, they're supposed to be what we call reporters of objective fact. But on the other hand, they're also supposed to be public advocates. They're also putting forth the kind of information that is required for voters to make an informed decision about what their government is going to do. And so what happened is when the politicians started going to the spin machines and started releasing press releases for media cycles and started constructing their speeches in ways that sound bites would be able to be run on the nightly news and the lead into the news and things
and
like
you
that.
You say when they began doing this, is there a, I mean, where are you looking at? As a
probably around the 80s and 90s with the advent, with the proliferation of channels and the CNNs and your
Fox
News.
So in other words,
News
the creation
like
of the 24-hour news cycle.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. And when politicians started adapting to the 24-hour news cycle, that idea of, well, I'm just going to parrot off what the politicians were saying, well, now you're almost a shield for the politicians because they are crafting their stories in a way to manipulate the public through the media. And so what the media decided to do was, well, now we're going to start putting on political commentators. matters, right?
So then we get entertainment.
Right. And we're going to put on pundits. And so the pundit is going to be the one that gets to come on and say, well, actually, that's incorrect because I've done this research. And then and so I know that this person isn't telling the truth. Well, now all of a sudden the pundits kind of become partisan in their own right. And so what does the media do? Well, now they get the actual reporters to do the interpretation. Well, you know, the statement that they made, actually, it's kind of true. Maybe it's not as true. And so then what we have is then you start getting all your talk about the mainstream media and things like that. So when PolitiFact comes along and FactCheck.org comes along, the media can say, hey, wait, let's point to this third party, this nonpartisan party that is saying, that is doing the interpreting for us and letting us know what's true and what's not. And so that's been the main benefit for the voter.
So here you're kind of pulling back the personality. And so by pulling it back and going more to an anonymous but bylined reporter, repertorial sort of approach to it, you get something that's a little closer to fact-checking rather than
exactly.
And then fact-spewing.
And the other benefit is by being on the internet, you know, there's unlimited amount of space, right? So if you're talking on a news program or on this, you know, radio program that we're doing now, there's a finite amount of time to actually explain. I can't explain Paul Ryan's budget in the space of this radio show or two more radio shows. On the internet, I can read page after page after page and actually accurately explain why this thing may be totally untrue or half true or totally correct.
And then I guess this might be a last question for you, but is there a possibility with that, though? Again, the internet, the proliferation of information that is available to you now, don't we get lost in all of that?
We get lost to a certain extent, but we do know where those fact-checking websites are, like FactCheck and like PolitiFact. And papers like the USA Today and different websites and things like that place these graphics so prominently that it's definitely a signal as to, hey, look here, we're going to check on this. One of the best things that PolitiFact does is that little meter that they have, because as soon as you see the meter, you can know exactly, hey, this is going to be a fact that has been verified and is either true or false.
In other words, that's a easily consumable, quick bite. And now I can go in and dig into the rest of the meat.
Exactly. And it's a symbol that this is an article or this is a point that has been verified in some way.
It's pretty brilliant.
It's marketing.
It's marketing. Everything is marketing at the end of the day, isn't it? All right. Well, thank you again, Ernest McGowan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, October 19th, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op in absentia is Rachel Solomon. This and past episodes of Open Source RVA are now available to listen to at your leisure. Log on to the Open Source RVA Facebook page for links to our podcasts, as well as more information on the news featured each week on WRIR's Audio News Digest. Hey, and don't forget to like us while you're there. Got a news tip? You want to correct our facts? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. And we'll meet you here next week for another edition of Open Source RVA. And I want to send a special shout out to my daughter, Olivia Paige Harrison, who turns 11 this week. Happy birthday, sweetheart. Oh!